Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. People whose hearts are failing have a couple of options. They can get a mechanical device, but artificial hearts don't last forever. They can get a heart transplant if someone donates an organ in time. Now, someday, doctors may be able to offer something else, a real heart grown in a lab. It sounds like science fiction, but one group in Minnesota has figured out a way to grow a heart and make it beat. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has the story.
It's no big deal to grow heart cells in a little dish, but take a second and picture your heart beating away in your chest. It's a round, meaty muscle the size of your fist with four chambers and a complicated network of blood vessels.
The heart is a beautiful, complex organ, and we realized pretty quickly that we weren't going to be able to figure out how to build that in a dish.
Doris Taylor runs a lab at the University of Minnesota. She says when nature builds a heart, the cells attach to a kind of scaffold or frame made of things like proteins.
It's basically what's underneath all of the cells, the tough part that the cells make to hold each other together.
Taylor and her colleagues thought, okay, what if we took a dead heart and found some way to remove all of the old cells, leaving the scaffold behind? They could then use the scaffold to construct a new heart out of young, healthy cells. Harold Ott worked in Taylor's lab, and he took this on as a kind of side project, something to fiddle with. He started treating rat hearts with a bunch of chemicals.
We had a big chemical shelf in the lab from A to Z, right? So I started using all sorts of chemicals starting at A, and every day perfused the rat heart with some sort of solution.
He tried enzymes. They dissolved the heart. Other chemicals made the heart swell and change shape. Then, one day, Ott grabbed a chemical known as SDS.
It's a regular component of shampoo. It's a soap.
At first, it seemed like nothing was happening. Then, patches on the heart began to turn white. The red part, the meaty part, was disappearing.
You can see the detergent working and making the heart literally translucent. So it turns into a jellyfish sort of appearance. Really, I mean, when you ever saw a jellyfish on the beach, that's exactly how it looks like.
Except this jellyfish was shaped just like a heart. All of the organ's 3D structure was still there. Then Ott and his colleagues took heart cells from newborn rats and put them onto the scaffold. The cells stuck, started to grow, and the heart became red again. But it didn't beat until the researchers added a tiny pacemaker. Then the heart began to rhythmically wiggle. After several days, it kept beating even without the pacemaker. Taylor says it was an amazing thing to see.
Our reaction was yes. It was the best we could possibly hope for.
The heartbeat wasn't that strong, just 2% of the pumping action of an adult heart. Still, Taylor thinks they can improve on this work, reported in the journal Nature Medicine. And she started working with pig hearts, which are about the size of human ones.
One possibility is that we could take a pig heart scaffold and then use your cells to repopulate that.
And since cells are always slowly replacing their scaffold, eventually the heart would be entirely yours. Taylor says this approach could also work for other organs. Her group has shown that they can get a similar kind of scaffold from the liver, lungs, and kidneys. William Wagner thinks the idea has potential. He's a scientist at the University of Pittsburgh who studies ways of trying to restore heart function.
This approach does address some of the major challenges that one faces in thinking about how to generate a functional heart that really has the structure and function of the native heart.
Still, he says, this is just a first step. There's lots of work to do before people could get organs grown in a lab. For example, you'd have to find a human cell that's very good at growing into new heart tissue. That's something that lots of scientists are looking for. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
Watch scientists make a beating heart. The video is at NPR.org. Speaking of messy things all in a tangle, let's talk for a moment about Christmas lights. The garden hose. That gold necklace. No matter how carefully you put these things away, when you take them out again, they're hopelessly knotted up. So this week on Science Out of the Box, we investigate the hows and whys of knots. Douglas Smith is a physics professor at the University of California in San Diego, and he's just published a paper on this thorny, or should I say knotty, problem. Hi there, Douglas Smith.
Hi.
So why does my jewelry knot itself up whenever I put it away?
Well, you might call it a kind of an example of Murphy's Law. But we have done kind of specific scientific studies to try to answer this question. We got interested in this because actually one of my students was interested in a mathematical field of knot theory. So mathematicians have kind of been thinking about knots for a very long time, for over 100 years. But it kind of occurred to us that knots in the real world and the physics of how knots actually come to form so annoyingly often, in life, hadn't really been well studied.
So what did you find?
Well, we basically did experiments and we found that just a little bit of kind of random jostling motion would very quickly tend to get a piece of string knotted. And then there's also many, many different kinds of knots that can form, increasingly complex. We put a length of string in a box, and we kind of spun the box the way the drum of your clothes dryer would spin and tumble your socks. We tumbled a piece of string, and we kind of watched it and asked, how long does it take to become knotted? How does it depend on, how many times you rotate the box and the length of the string and the flexibility of the string in this. So we tried to very carefully control the experiment to understand the phenomena.
And you're not just playing around here with knots. This is not sort of a Boy Scout endeavor. You're actually trying to understand, as I gather, something about more organic things, DNA, proteins.
Well, that's right. On the one hand, you can think of it as a kind of a fun little physics project that the sort of nerdy physicist would like to do.
Nerdy physicist? No.
Oh, yes. That's, we definitely are. But on the other hand, there are real-life situations where you have this. And so one of the things that we were interested in is the tendency of DNA molecules, which are essentially also strings, just very tiny strings inside your body, to get tangled and knotted. And sometimes that has serious consequences, like when a cell copies its DNA and is going to try to divide into two cells, if the two copies of the DNA get themselves tangled or knotted, then those two cells can't divide. And we could try to jump right to studying DNA, but it's difficult. So we thought to ourselves, well, if nobody really even understands how a common piece of string ends up getting in a knot, we better try to understand that first and then move on, potentially later to look at DNA.
Knots are really a basic human problem. They're really kind of universal.
People seem to have a fascination with them, believe it or not.
Douglas Smith is an assistant professor of physics at the University of California in San Diego. He and his student Dorian Raymer published this paper called Spontaneous Knotting of an Agitated String. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We're awfully early with this next one. In about 20 million years or so, astronomers are predicting that a giant cloud of gas will collide with our home galaxy, the Milky Way. NPR's Richard Harris has more on this galactic surprise.
In 1963, a young astronomer in Holland named Gale Smith discovered a giant cloud of hydrogen gas lurking just beyond our galaxy. She went on to do other things, and the Smith cloud was more or less forgotten. But recently, Jay Lockman at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia, decided to take a look. He got interested, obsessively interested. Using a radio telescope, he mapped 40,000 locations in the Smith cloud in order to cobble together a picture of what the Smith cloud looks like.
It really looks like a comet. It has a very condensed head and these trails of gas billowing out behind it.
Lockman unveiled the image today at the American Astronomical Society meeting in Austin, Texas.
Just one look at the image, that it's falling into the Milky Way. There's no question about which way it's going.
And it's huge. If you could actually see that cloud of gas in the sky, it would appear to be much bigger than the moon. When it gets here, blam! Lachman says it's going to collide with other gas clouds that at the moment are sitting rather peacefully out in the nether reaches of the galaxy.
And new stars might pop out of them, kind of like raindrops condensing out of a cloud. So the result could actually be quite spectacular.
But don't bother to set up your lawn chair just yet. We still have a little bit of a wait for it to collide with the Milky Way. Hard to say if it will slow down from its current speed.
But if it's in free fall, then in about 20 million years or so, it's going to hit. It's very close right now as distances go.
But if you're worried about your progeny 20 million years hence, relax. Looks like the Smith Cloud is not going to hit our particular arm of the Milky Way.
It's going to be about a quarter of the way around the Milky Way from the sun when it hits.
So you're saying we don't have to send Bruce Willis out there to stop it or anything?
No. But I tell you, somewhere out around a quarter of the way around the galaxy, there's some astronomer who's probably just now looking up and saying, oh, wow, what is this thing coming toward us?
There's a more local astronomer also interested in this news, and that would be Gail Smith, now Gail Bigger Smith, who discovered the cloud decades ago. She settled in Holland and is no longer an astronomer, but she's thrilled to hear that her cloud turned out to be exciting.
Well, if it's going to cause catastrophe, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be so happy about it, but of course it is exciting.
Yeah, in 20 million years, who's going to blame you?
Yeah, well, I guess so.
Richard Harris, NPR News.
Surely you've heard that shaving makes your hair grow back faster and coarser, and that we only use about 10% of our brains. There is a lot of homegrown medical wisdom out there, and it's tough to separate some of the myths from the real science. Family physician and former Assistant Surgeon General Douglas Camero is here to debunk some of those common beliefs.
I used to work for the medical journal BMJ, which is published in London and was formerly called the British Medical Journal. One of the things I like best about the BMJ is its humor and irreverent style. A great example of this is a recent article by two Indiana University doctors, Rachel Vreeman and Aaron Carroll. It critically examines some strongly held medical beliefs that you may have heard from your mother, or even from your doctor, that aren't quite true. For example, reading in dim light ruins your eyesight. If you spent your childhood reading with a flashlight under the covers, you can rest assured. Although poor lighting can cause squinting and dry eyes temporarily, there's no evidence that any permanent damage is done. When you think about it, lighting has only improved since the days when everyone read by candlelight, and vision hasn't gotten any better. In fact, nearsightedness is more common these days with better lighting. Or how about the old saw that we only use 10% of our brains? This one apparently has been around since the turn of the last century, and it's been falsely attributed to Albert Einstein. Modern medical imaging, however, shows that we use much more than 10% of our brains. Essentially, no areas of the brain are completely inactive, and studies of people with brain injuries have found that damage to virtually any part of the brain is associated with specific and lasting negative effects. Okay, well, here's one that everyone knows is true. Shaving causes hair to grow back faster or coarser. If you're a woman, I guarantee someone has told you this at least once. For this one, we have strong evidence that it's a myth. Clinical trials have proven that shaving has no effect on the rate of hair growth or on the thickness of the hair that grows back. What unshaven hair does have is a finer taper at the end that may make it look less coarse. And newly grown hair looks darker because the sun hasn't had a chance to bleach it. Speaking of hair, have you ever been told that hair and fingernails continue to grow even after someone dies? What's going on here, it turns out, is that post-mortem drying of the skin can cause it to retract around the hair and nails, making it look like they're growing. But there's no way that the hair and nails actually continue to grow without the ongoing delivery of nutrients that a beating heart delivers. Finally, how many diet articles and books have you read that advocate drinking at least 8 glasses of water a day? No one knows exactly where this one came from, but it might be from a leading nutritionist in the 1970s. It turns out that there's no such requirement. Thirst is the best guide for how much you need to drink, and drinking liquids in excessive amounts can actually be dangerous, as we see in the occasional marathon runner who overdrinks, gets water intoxication, and dies. Bottom line, don't believe everything your mother or maybe even your doctor tells you.
That's family physician Douglas Camero. He's a former assistant surgeon general, and he's a health service researcher and columnist. He lives in Maryland. A link to the full BMJ article on medical myths is available on the web at npr.org. Well, now to another long-running conflict, this one ecological. On the savannas of Africa, giant elephants are pitted against angry ant swarms that live in trees. And according to a new study, one of the worst things that could happen in this conflict is for the two sides to find peace. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
If trees could feel emotions, there is nothing that would scare them more than the sight of an approaching elephant, according to Todd Palmer, an ecologist with the University of Florida at Gainesville.
Elephants eat trees. They don't eat parts of trees. They can eat a tree, much like we would eat a cupcake.
We reached Palmer on a cell phone at his research site in Kenya. That's where he goes to study a small African tree that has found a way to repel hungry elephants. Palmer says these trees ooze tasty sap that attracts nasty ants and then makes the ants even nastier. He says a single one of these trees can hold 100,000 of the ants, which is very bad news for any elephant that decides to chow down on a branch.
So imagine 100,000 ants streaming across the tree towards this point of disturbance. At some point, enough is enough, and you're going to have a face covered in these biting, stinging ants.
Palmer says he's watched these ants charge straight into an elephant's trunk, which is famously sensitive. Now, scientists call this kind of ant-tree alliance a mutualism, which has a kind of peaceful ring to it, but not in this case, according to Palmer.
It's a co-evolutionary war. People think of mutualisms as a friendly sort of situation where species are helping each other out. But what it really is a battlefield.
And on this particular battlefield, a tiny insect trumps the biggest land animal on Earth. But that got Palmer wondering. What would happen to the ant-tree alliance if the common enemy, elephants, was gone? To find out, he put great big fences up around some of his trees, which are known locally as whistling thorns, and then he watched them for 10 years. Palmer expected these trees to flourish with no elephants around, but no. Some of them grew half as fast as before, and many died, and all of them stopped producing that tasty sap. That drove off all the ants that had once guarded them from the elephants.
These trees, in the absence of herbivores, decided, well, the herbivores are gone, so it doesn't make a lot of sense to pay these ant bodyguards as much. So let's reduce the salary, in essence, that we're paying these bodyguards.
Palmer says the sap reductions turned out to be a big mistake. That's because the guard ants were quickly replaced by other insects that attacked the trees, digging lots of ugly holes and tunnels.
Like the tree's riddled with cancer or something. It's basically, if you cut open a cross-section of a tree, all it is just this torn-up inside with massive numbers of tunnels and dead branch systems everywhere.
This is an experiment that shows just how powerful and complicated natural alliances can be, says Mark Burtness, a biologist with Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. But more importantly, he says, it shows that you never know what you're going to get when you mess with Mother Nature.
And this is a great example of how, without these mutualisms, the community collapses.
Burtness says it's possible that similar collapses could take place in other parts of Africa where elephant populations are now in trouble. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, we're going to look at the invention of television as portrayed in a new Broadway play, The Farnsworth Invention. But up next, what if doctors could tell which teens and young adults at high risk for developing schizophrenia or other psychotic illnesses, what if they could tell which one of them are actually going to get sick before they've had a full-blown psychotic episode? Well, research suggests that earlier the doctors can identify and treat patients, the better off those patients are. They've also known that a number of risk factors, including a family history of psychotic illness, certain changes in perception and thinking, These all together, taken together, can predict a psychotic illness. And now a new study shows that if researchers look for these particular combinations of risk factors, they can predict with much more accuracy which teens will get sick. Very high, very good predictions, as you'll find out. We're going to talk about it with the researcher who is part of the panel of researchers out in this week's issue of the Archives of General Psychology. And joining us now to talk about it is one of the study's lead authors, Tyrone Cannon, who is the Staglin Family Professor of Psychology, Psychiatry, and Biobehavioral Sciences, and director of the Staglin Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of California, L.A. He joins us today from L.A. Welcome to the program, Dr. Cannon.
Thank you, Ira. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Your paper looked at ways to predict the onset of psychotic illnesses. Give us an idea of what kind of illnesses we're talking about here.
Well, psychosis is a broad term that applies to symptoms of loss of touch with reality. And, you know, the most common examples of those are things like hallucinations, hearing voices, or delusions, having unusual beliefs about others' intentions and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Those kinds of symptoms are quite prevalent in a disorder called schizophrenia, the diagnosis of schizophrenia, but they also appear sometimes in other conditions such as bipolar disorder and major depression.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your study. What did you look for and what did you find that were the telling indicators that this could indeed lead to these illnesses in some of these people?
Well, the first, we did two things. The first thing was we were trying to verify whether a particular set of risk criteria that were used to diagnose a high-risk syndrome, which we call the psychosis prodrome, whether those were valid in terms of having a higher, you know, indicating mm-hmm. a group that had a high risk. And what we found is that young people who met those criteria over a 2.5-year period, 35% of them developed a full-blown psychotic illness. And the risk for doing so was highest within the first 12 months and then gradually dropped off so that by about 2.5 years, the risk had declined substantially. So there was an interesting sort of deceleration in the risk for them converting to full-blown illness.
Mm-hmm. And what is the single best predictor of a full-blown illness?
Well, so that risk category itself ascertains 35% of the cases who develop full psychosis within 2.5 years. Within that group, we did additional analyses to see if we could refine the prediction, improve it even further by considering combinations of risk factors that were assessed at the baseline, things like, as you were noting in your introduction to the segment, family history of a major mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, mm-hmm. Having a substantial decline in social, school, or occupational functioning in, you know, recently, like in the past 6 to 12 months, having higher levels of these unusual thoughts and perceptions that aren't yet of psychotic intensity but are certainly thought to be on a continuum with those kinds of symptoms.
And when you put all those factors together, you get a very good prediction.
You get, well, you, what you do is you ask 80% of the people who have those three factors at the same time develop psychosis within 2.5 years.
80%?
80%. And so now that isn't to say that everybody who developed psychosis had that profile mm-hmm. of risk factors. It's really to say that if you had that particular profile, then your risk was really high.
Mm-hmm. And what makes you think that, you know, if everybody who hears this is going to say, oh, you know, I hear voices every now and then, and I do this, and
sure.
I have med student syndrome, you know. what's going to prevent everybody from thinking they have this? What?
Well, you know, I obviously when things like this are in the news, everybody kind of turns inward for a while and sort of gives himself a gut check. But symptoms like hearing a voice call your name, which is one of the early features that we found were quite common in this high risk group. When there's a very large segment of the population that reports that symptom mm-hmm. in complete isolation. So that is, they don't have the other things, the impaired functioning or unusual thoughts or a family history. Mm-hmm. So these, you know, obviously these kinds of syndromes are very complex and have lots of causes.
So is this study then an alert to doctors to be on the lookout to find these earlier so they can be treated?
Absolutely. We think the main immediate implication is that with these improved risk prediction criteria, essentially what we can do is target particular individuals for early intervention, particularly with psychological treatments that are designed to help the young person adapt to their changed mental abilities and mm-hmm. Succeed in school and stay somewhat connected with peers and their families, and then have a more intensive monitoring so that if they do develop full psychosis, then antipsychotic drug treatment could be initiated sooner than is typical in the general population. Mm-hmm. We have in general, we have a very long lag between when an individual develops full psychotic symptoms and they're coming to the attention of coming into medical treatment. And the research database suggests that the longer that time period that lapses in between, you know, onset and initial treatment, the worse the long-term outcome. So there's some evidence to suggest that if we can detect the onsets earlier, we can initiate treatment earlier and thereby improve the overall course.
Well, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us, Dr. Cannon, and good luck to you and your research.
My pleasure.
Tyrone Cannon is a professor of psychology, psychiatry, and behavioral sciences and director of the Staglin Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at UCLA.